We are establishing a fairly aggressive timeline to address that backlog, and that is set for weeks, not months.
State officials work to clear out the Medicaid program waiting list. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 31st of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Mat-Su Borough considers a sales tax.
The average homeowner is going to save over $700 on their property tax.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business, or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
State and federal agencies are deciding what it will take to lift the federal suspension on new applications for personal care assistance and Medicaid-related services. The federal moratorium was put in place after a review found the state had a backlog of some 2,000 people who needed assessments or reassessments of their cases to determine the kind of care they needed. And clearing up that backlog is the state's initial goal. Kimberly Poppy Smart is the state's project manager charged with directing the response to the shortfalls found in the review. She says the Division of Senior and Disability Services has already begun addressing the issues, and she has a deadline of having a documented corrective action plan in place by September 1st.
It is absolutely our goal to meet the requirements that they set forth and develop a plan to meet those requirements within a reasonable time frame. There is the primary goal of lifting the moratorium so that we can again assess individuals and direct them to programs for which they're appropriate.
Poppy Smart says the long-term goal is to have a quality assurance program in place to regain complete service to the public, although the federal government will hold the final authority on whether to lift the suspension. She says the public will see the results in several stages.
We are establishing a fairly aggressive timeline to address that backlog, and that is set for weeks, not months. So we anticipate they will see a large enough accomplishment towards that end that they will agree to lift the moratorium.
She says complete compliance with all aspects of the corrective action plan could take well into next year. Matanuska Valley residents will be asked to approve a new sales tax on this fall's borough ballot. This week, the Mat-Su Borough Assembly approved a 3% sales tax to relieve homeowner property taxes, although new borough mayor Kohlberg is not on board. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The sales tax proposal was co-sponsored by Assembly members Cindy Bettini and Pete Houston. The measure seeks to relieve Valley property owners of more than $24 million in taxes by using a sales tax to lower the mill rate from the current 9.9 to 7.3. That's a rate not seen since the late 1980s. Cindy Bettini says the proposal will be put before the voters.
It totally ties the reduction in the mill rate to the sales tax. We have also added a sunset clause into the ballot proposition so that on June 30th, 2014, the voters would have an opportunity to vote on this again, because then we'll have an idea of exactly how much revenue the sales tax will produce.
The proposal reduces the assessed value on primary residences, saving homeowners more than $5 million in taxes. The reduced mill rate proposed by the measure results in almost $19 million in tax reductions, according to the sponsors. The proposal also creates an excess sales tax revenue fund, which directs excess sales tax collections to mill rate reductions in coming years. The Assembly approved the ballot measure by a 5 5-2 vote, and that's enough to override any veto by the borough mayor. But Mayor Talis Kohlberg vetoed it anyway in a crisp letter addressed to the assembly the next morning. Kohlberg says the sales tax is less about revenue diversification than it is about hiking taxes in a time of great economic difficulty for many people. The mayor says the tax is a windfall for non-resident property owners in the valley, while it reallocates taxes to the shoulders of the working poor during a serious recession. Assembly members Tom Kluberton and Mark Ewing sided with the mayor's point of view and voted against the tax proposal. The sales tax now must be approved by borough voters in October. More than 600 residents responded to a telephone poll used to determine public opinion on the tax proposal. 62% of those who responded supported the tax hike. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Governor Sean Parnell says he will fight a court challenge to Alaska's $50 per person cruise ship passenger fee. Cruise line officials have said they will likely sue to kill the tax put in place by voters in 2006. Some Southeast tourism leaders meeting in Juneau last week said they might do the same. The new governor says there's no question he'll tell state lawyers to oppose any such move.
Absolutely. I mean, if it's on the books, we will defend the law as it stands.
Some tourism leaders are also asking lawmakers to remove the tax. Speaking to reporters in Juneau on Wednesday, Parnell said he wasn't ready to state his position on that effort.
You know, if the legislature wants to take that up and debate it, I'll certainly participate in that policy discussion. My sense right now is that I am maintaining a stable tax structure, and we're looking at the overall economy and how to benefit the overall economy.
Industry leaders are also pushing for an increase in marketing funds. Parnell says he understands visitor numbers are down, but he's not ready to commit to a particular budget figure.
Our tour industry is feeling the pinch, and that means that associated contractors and vendors who service the industry are feeling the pinch as well. And when it comes to tourism marketing, I've always supported tourism marketing. What level that will look like, that remains to be developed through the budget process.
Industry officials say Alaska is far behind competing states' marketing efforts. They're pushing legislation giving cruise lines a credit against income tax payments for contributions made toward marketing. Backers hope the effort will increase funds from about $12 million to about $20 million, including government and private sector money. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a push in Washington to end aerial predator control.
The state predator control programs, particularly these aerial gunning programs, are not based, in our view, on sound science.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Aerial wolf control is under fire in Washington. A duo of Democratic senators have introduced the Protect America's Wildlife Act, which would prohibit hunters from shooting wildlife from aircraft. The State Department of Fish and Game says it would destroy Alaska's predator control program. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
Senators Dianne Feinstein of California and Ben Cardin of Maryland say their bill would end what they call the inhumane practice of shooting wildlife from planes. They say it closes a loophole in the 1971 Aerial Hunting Act, which allows private citizens to hunt from aircraft for wildlife management. The Feinstein-Cardin bill would limit the practice only to federal and state wildlife agency employees and only in times of biological emergency. Feinstein specifically took a swipe in a press release at Alaska's practice of predator control. The group Defenders of Wildlife has endorsed the bill, and its vice president for government relations, Robert Dewey, says it's within Congress's right to have a say over Alaska's wolf control program.
Decades ago, Congress passed the Federal Airborne Hunting Act, which specifically intended to rein in the aerial hunting of wolves in Alaska and elsewhere. And yet, the state has managed a way to circumvent this practice by calling it wildlife management.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game oversees the state's programs. Deputy Commissioner Patrick Valkenburg says the Feinstein-Cardin bill would prevent the state from managing its wildlife.
You'd never get to the point where you'd ever do aerial wolf control anymore. The bill essentially makes aerial wolf control impossible except for endangered species. So it really makes it impossible for the state to manage game populations.
Valkenburg says it could also hurt research projects, and he says it ignores the needs of rural Alaska.
Food animals, particularly moose, caribou, and deer, are really important to Alaskans, particularly rural Alaskans, for food. And we would not be able to manage populations for food for people in rural Alaska if predation ever became a problem there, which it is in many areas.
Alaska has 6 active wolf control programs, and Valkenburg says they're taking place on less than 10% of the state's land. He could not provide a total of the number of wolves killed this year, but in one of the programs in east central Alaska, Valkenburg says 84 wolves were shot and killed. He says that should significantly help build up that region's 40-mile caribou herd population. But Robert Dewey with Defenders of Wildlife says he doesn't buy that the program has positive results.
There is very poor data to back up the state's programs. The state predator control programs, particularly these arrow gunning programs, are not based, in our view, on sound science and should be conducted by state personnel.
Fish and Game's Patrick Valkenburg says that's exactly what the state did this year in the East Central Alaska program. It used state employees instead of giving permits to private citizens.
In the past, a lot of the criticism was that if you're going to do wolf control from the air, you should use department staff and helicopters to do it. And this time around, that's exactly what we did do. And yet we get more criticism than we got before the previous program. And I think the reason that we're getting it is because the program is effective.
The Feinstein-Cardin bill would also ban land and shoot hunting, that is, chasing wolves from aircraft to tire them out before the shooting starts. And it would increase fines for violations of airborne hunting from $5,000 to $50,000. The new bill comes on the heels of heightened attention to the debate over wolf control. Defenders of Wildlife's Robert Dewey says his group's work to protect wolves has gotten more attention since former Governor Sarah Palin burst onto the national stage last year. The group has run ad campaigns specifically targeting the governor and her support of wolf control.
It has been a source of ongoing disagreement, shall we say, strong disagreement with the former governor. But it's important to emphasize that this has been a longstanding controversy and one that defenders and many Alaskans have been working to end for a long time.
Former Governor Palin appeared to take a swipe in her resignation speech last weekend at Defenders of Wildlife when she said outside political interests would be attacking what she called hunting and Second Amendment gun ownership rights. Palin said the groups would use tiny celebrity starlets to fundraise. This year, Defenders of Wildlife used actress Ashley Judd in an ad campaign that blasted Palin and Alaska's aerial wolf control policy. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
In the Central Peninsula region, rising water is affecting some areas after days of rain and seasonal glacier melt. The Russian River Ferry is temporarily closed. Robin West, manager of the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, says that the water is definitely high in that area.
At the Russian River confluence, we saw about a 6-inch increase yesterday, and clearly at flood stage, and the folks that operate the ferry were assessing it this morning, weren't comfortable with operating it. It's a current-driven ferry, and they certainly want to run it because that makes them money, but they're evaluating it every few hours, and right now, though, it's sitting and not taking folks across.
As for now, though, Wes says while it might not be the best time for it, the river is not closed to rafting.
There aren't any restrictions on fishing right now. We have had quite a few folks who have got into trouble on the river. Rafts getting caught up in log jams and that kind of thing. And so it's not a great time to be going on a rafting trip in the upper river, but it is not closed.
There was an incident above Jim's Landing earlier this week when a raft with 10 people in it overturned. Only minor injuries were reported. A flood advisory has again been extended for the Kenai River through Monday. A group that first worked to raise awareness about the dangers posed by former military installations on St. Lawrence Island is now broadening its work to include the entire Norton Sound region. From KNOM in Nome, Jesse Zink reports.
St. Lawrence Island, off the coast of the Seward Peninsula, is one of the closest parts of Alaska to the Russian mainland. During the Cold War, the military installed a White Atlas site on the island's northeast cape as part of its early warning system. There was another installation at the other end of the island near the community of Gamble.
St. Lawrence Island was the eyes and ears of the North during the Cold War, and they basically abandoned Northeast Cape. They were there over 20 years, and at Gamble, they dug big pits and buried everything.
Vi Waihi was raised on St. Lawrence Island and now works for Alaska Community Action on Toxics. Her group has worked with islanders over the last several years to document the effects of the contaminants left behind at the defense sites. Savunga's Jane Kava has been involved with the research effort in her community, conducting household surveys.
Through the surveys, we've noticed that in every family we go into, there's always somebody that's had cancer, that's died from cancer, or that's recovered from cancer. There's also a lot of thyroid and respiratory problems, which we've never had before.
With grant money from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, ACAT held a week-long course in Nome last month with students from 12 villages in the region. Students learned how to conduct their own environmental sampling program to monitor some of the estimated 30 formerly used defense sites in the region. Kava says they've used a wide range of techniques in Savunga to keep track of changes.
We started out doing elder interviews. We need to listen to what they have to say, use their words to recognize that things are changing, health-wise and weather-wise. We did blood samples, and all the levels we found in the blood samples were higher than anywhere else in the United States. Currently, we're doing health surveys. We're testing our food.
The effect on subsistence resources in some parts of the island has been particularly pronounced, says Waihi.
At Northeast Cape, the Soke River, which was one of the most abundant fishing rivers on our island, there's no more fish. Fish have never returned. We have no more seal haulouts just off the coast of Northeast Cape, plus no more tomcod fishing. The plants that we've tested for contaminants, there's PCBs in them.
The Army Corps of Engineers has led a cleanup effort in the region for the past several years. Community members are involved in the process through local restoration advisory boards. Still, Waihi says it's a slow payback for the help the military received.
Our people welcome the military. They help rescue downed planes. Our men joined the Alaska National Guard. And our people are very patriotic of our contributions. And the injustice done by the military, not only on our island, but in a lot of these other Norton Sound communities, it's been really hard trying to hold the military accountable.
Reporting from Nome, I'm Jesse Zink.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
This weekend is the 5th annual Alaska Renewable Energy Fair held on the Park Strip near downtown Anchorage. One of the speakers at this year's event is Iowa Governor Chet Culver. Culver says he ran on a renewable energy platform in 2006, and the state now has a $100 million pot of money called the Iowa Power Fund that invests in what Culver says are second and third generation renewable energy technology ideas to create green-collar jobs. He says the fund has invested in everything from wind storage in caves to algae.
Trying to convert algae into power, there's not really a fund like this in the nation. We're looking at diversification. So people make application to our Power Fund board with all of these exciting different projects. We've now invested about $50 million, and we've leveraged hundreds of million dollars additionally in federal funds and private sector investment.
And what has this meant on the ground for economic development in your state? Are you seeing the creation of jobs based on these things?
In fact, the Power Fund is investing in a cellulosic ethanol plant, for example, in Emmitsburg, Iowa. It would be the first commercially viable cellulosic ethanol plant in the United States. So we are trying to convert corn cobs at that plant into a renewable fuel. The other thing that's happening is we are fast becoming the Silicon Prairie of the Midwest. We want to do in Iowa, the exciting kind of cutting edge research and development that was done in California, you know, during the information technology boom. We have these small businesses that are popping up all over our state. In Ames, Iowa, for example, where Iowa State University is, they're doing some phenomenal things related to solar power and manufacturing solar panels at one of the businesses that the Power Fund is supporting as well.
You mentioned a facility that would use corn cobs as a source of energy. How much of the economic development, the Iowa Power Fund, involves the state's number one product, which is corn?
Well, we're really looking at value-added alternatives when it comes to corn and soybeans. So the Power Fund is interested in cellulosic ethanol and biodiesel-related research and development projects. Soy lubricant, we believe that we could help lubricate every rail line in the United States of America using soy-based lubricant as opposed to petroleum-based lubricant, which they currently use on most rail lines. And I'm here in Alaska to join the Alaska Renewable Energy Project and the renewable energy advocates here in Anchorage this weekend to see how we can partner and work together to collaborate and educate and inform Alaskans and Americans from coast to coast about, you know, what's possible when it comes to really securing our energy future and dealing with really serious issues related to climate change and, most importantly, creating potentially millions of green-collar jobs in this country.
And Governor Culver, when you talk about green-collar jobs, you've been talking about a lot of the projects that are ongoing in Iowa. What else does that encompass? What exactly are green-collar jobs?
Well, we have been very aggressive in Iowa in recruiting wind energy companies in particular to our state. So in the last 3 years, we've had 9 companies in the wind energy business come to Iowa to set up manufacturing facilities. We are one of only 2 states that is currently manufacturing the 3 component parts of a windmill: towers, turbines, and blades. So we are making these component parts in Iowa. And as a result, we're creating really good-paying manufacturing jobs. In addition, we're creating permanent maintenance jobs. We have about 2,100 wind turbines that are up and running across the state of Iowa. We're going to produce 15% of all of our energy in Iowa from wind, and we need talented and capable workers to maintain those turbines, to keep them operating and to service them on a regular basis. You can make $50,000 or $60,000 a year as a wind maintenance technician. And in some cases, you only need an associate's degree from a community college to go right into the job market and make a very, very good living in one of these new green jobs. And then in addition, the supply chain is following these companies. So thousands of small business-related jobs are being created to support the larger manufacturing facilities that are making the towers and the turbines and blades.
Iowa Governor Chet Culver will be speaking at 6 p.m. at the Renewable Energy Fair in Anchorage tomorrow. Petersburg City Council took the first step toward joining a fledgling effort for dealing with the Southeast region's trash and recyclable materials. The council approved an ordinance that would allow Petersburg to take part in a Southeast Alaska Solid Waste Authority with other Panhandle communities. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
The ordinance would allow for creation of a new regional corporation with a board of directors represented by any community that joins in the effort. The new corporation would be charged with collection and transportation as well as storage of trash and could issue revenue bonds for buying or developing a regional landfill or similar facility. The Regional Economic Development Organization Southeast Conference has been studying the idea to help the region's municipalities cut down on the cost of shipping garbage out of state. It also could be a possible solution for communities that are filling up existing landfills. The state legislature passed a bill in 2006, sponsored by Wrangell Republican Peggy Wilson, that allowed for creation of such an organization. Public Works Director Carl Hagerman said the Solid Waste Authority would be similar to the Inter-Island Ferry Authority.
And all this does is this allows communities in the region to form this authority to research better ways, hopefully more stable and cost-efficient ways, to handle our solid waste in the region. It's a real positive thing. There's virtually no risk involved in getting involved in this. We can always pull out if it doesn't work.
Hagerman said it would be up to the future board of the new authority to decide how to proceed on a regional landfill or other solutions.
We are not asking the council to decide on what the solution is or where it's going to be. Nothing like that. That's the work of the authority after it's formed. It's just at this point, it has to go through three readings of the city council, have it passed, and then get on the ballot so that the voters can decide as well.
Petersburg has been paying a contractor to ship its baled garbage to a landfill in Washington State for over a decade. There was little discussion among the council members Monday night, although Councilor Lee Corio supported the idea.
This is an important step.
It is.
It needs to happen.
Yes.
And earlier in the day, during a radio call-in, Mayor Al Dwyer said Petersburg should be involved in the effort.
The towns are going to join together and try to find a less expensive way to deal with solid waste. And part of that is finding a place to put it, and the other part is finding a place to ship it out if we can't find a place to put it.
Besides a regional landfill, the authority may also look at energy generation from burning garbage, along with collecting recyclables and composting. Southeast Conference and nine communities have already teamed up for an annual collection of household hazardous waste. The vote was 4-0 to approve the ordinance in its first reading. Councilors Melinda Hofstede and Mark Jensen were not at the meeting. The ordinance needs to pass two more readings by the council before it goes on the local ballot this October. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, Ben Stanton in Kenai, and Jesse Zink in Nome. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Pan Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at panair.com.
And by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world. The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN, covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.